Episode 298 of the Pilot to Pilot podcast takes off now. Fly with Garmin Avionics, then grab your mobile device and make the Garmin Pilot app your cockpit companion. Get advanced functions you'll use before, during, and after every flight, including updating your aircraft's databases and logging engine data. Plan, file, fly, log with Garmin Pilot. The Pilot to Pilot podcast is brought to you by Learn the Finer Points. Use the link below to save 10% off their ground school app. Aviation, there's a new offer from SiriusXM. Make sure you upgrade your next flight without upgrading your plane by getting the Garmin GDL52 portable receiver. The GDL52 has ADS-B traffic and weather plus SiriusXM weather and entertainment. It has Bluetooth and works with Garmin Pilot apps. For a limited time, you can get a $300 rebate on the GDL52, plus it comes with a free 3-month trial of SiriusXM's weather and entertainment. I love flying with SiriusXM, and it's honestly one of my favorite features about having the G5000, so the GDL52 will offer you a very similar outlook on the weather and also getting to listen to some awesome radio stations on SiriusXM. So check out the GDL52 at aopa.org/SiriusXM.
Jim Higgins, professor of aviation, University of North Dakota.
Aviation, what is going on? And welcome back to the Pilot to Pilot podcast. My name is Justin Seams, and I am your host. Today's episode is a state of the industry, a very, very requested state of the industry, as there is a lot going on right now. The whole JetBlue Spirit debacle that's going on and how the DOJ has said that merger cannot happen. Spirit kind of coming out and saying that they're not in the best shape. It's an interesting time right now. So I'm very excited to have Jim on. He emailed Jim, was like, hey, you want to do a podcast tomorrow? He goes, sure. So very glad that he is down to do these last minute podcasts, because sometimes the news just happens really quick. But Aviation, I want to keep you guys much longer from this intro. Check out the hats. You can go to boldaviator.com, find some sweet gear and find some hats there. And also make sure you're following Pilot to Pilot, because there was a question box. If you wanted your question answered today, that was your opportunity for this podcast. So follow us on Pilot to Pilot so you can have your question answered by either me or Jim. Most likely Jim, because he's definitely the smarter one. Aviation, I hope you're having a great day. And without any further ado, here's State of the Industry with Dr. Jim Higgins. Jim, what's going on, man? Welcome back to the Pilot to Pilot podcast. Well, I should say the State of the Industry podcast, right?
Yeah. No, happy to be here, Justin. Always happy to come and talk to you and your listeners.
Yeah.
I guess I can see viewers now, right?
Viewers, yeah, we can wave. Hey, look at that. We're real people. This is probably the first time I've ever seen you, to be honest with you. That's funny. It's crazy. I feel like we started this around the COVID time, and people really like this. They have asked me so many times, when's Jim coming back on? When's Jim coming back on? It's like, we're going to do it. I promise. We're going to do it. COVID with you and the last couple of months, just living life, man, trying to get through day by day with a 2-year-old and a wife that's in residency. But here we are. We are talking about the industry right now. And it's really interesting. If we could go back and listen from the first podcast that we did until now, just seeing the difference of where they've come and just truly showing how, for lack of a better word, how crazy and just insane this industry is, and how it could just turn on a dime, right? Like COVID seemed as low as it could possibly get and never get worse than that. And we're currently in a high. Maybe we reached the peak and starting to come back down a little bit with some rough waters ahead for some airlines, for some people. Get a lot of questions. Is this still a good industry for me to get in? Which is crazy to think about. Because we didn't know what the industry was going to look like 5 years or three, or was it 2024? So 4 years ago.
Four years ago.
Yeah, a lot to talk about. So let's rip the Band-Aid off. I put a question out on Instagram. If you don't follow me on Pilot to Pilot, go follow there, because I always put at least question box, especially for a podcast like this. But I asked, what do you want to talk about? And I promise you, probably the first 100 responses was Spirit, JetBlue. So from your point of view, what is, obviously we all know the latest, right? It was blocked. Merger was blocked, I should say. But from your point of view, how is this all playing out? Is this it? Is this the final thing, you think? Or, do you think they're still kind of in the process of getting this approved?
It's a great question. You know, I think it was certainly unexpected by JetBlue, certainly unexpected by Spirit. I think, you know, JetBlue is saying, well, wait a minute, you know, what about some of the more recent mergers at some of the larger carriers? Why is this, which is going to be smaller than that? Why was that construed as interference or anti-consumer or whatever the rationale was? And I think it's a legitimate point. You know, there is a place in court. You know, you can keep appealing it. You can keep trying different ways. It's very expensive for carriers to even begin merger negotiations because you basically, I mean, the general rule of thumb is you have to take a third of your management team from each carrier, and they basically have to spend the time going through all the integration issues. You know, think of every conceivable thing two operations would integrate. It's very, very complicated. And so there's a lot of lost productivity, a lot of lost time. And so the question is, do they just admit defeat and, you know, go their separate ways, or do they keep fighting on? My guess is they're probably done. There's some complicating factors there. One of them is apparently JetBlue has to pay Spirit $450 million or something like that if this was not completed, if it failed. And so it'll be interesting to see how that plays out in court. I don't know. You know, another issue hanging over the situation is with Spirit is they have not been the most profitable carrier lately. You know, I think they lost $157 million last quarter, which, you know, most of the air carriers right now are profitable and they've been in some pretty good profitability. So that in and of itself is a cause for concern. Then you compound it with this. I know Wall Street's getting nervous. There's been a couple of analysts that have come out saying, hey, this is a big problem. I mean, the B word's even been mentioned as a possibility down the road, which is, you know, bankruptcy, which of course would just be unfathomable, you know, at this apex of growth. And I don't want to be a fear monger and say that's going to happen. I don't know that that's going to happen, but it is interesting how that's being talked about. So there could be some longer term ramifications here.
So how did we get here? Like how, obviously the first time they kind of came out, they said, hey, we're not going to, the mergers, I don't know if it was an official ruling, but they sent it back to them like, all right, you got to give them more gates. You got to make this more fair, which is kind of just how mergers have gone. And then they usually get passed on. What eventually do you think, obviously it's probably skepticism, right? We can't really speak for the judge other than what the words that he used.
Right.
His closing terms or something were like, right. For the people that love to fly Spirit and said no. It's like, yeah, what a weird, I don't know, not almost say unprofessional, but just a very strange way to say no and kind of close it out. But talk a little bit about kind of how we've gotten here.
Well, you know, it is very political and I hate to say that, but you know, it really depends on the philosophy. Remember, even though we are in a deregulated industry, the airline industry in theory, the truth is in 1976, they called it the regulatory reform, deregulation, airline deregulation. Most of us call it more like regulatory reform because we never fully deregulated. If we were fully deregulated and it was pure market forces, anyone could merge with any, but we'd probably have one carrier today, right? One mega carrier, something like that. And so the government they're supposed to look in both the DOJ and the DOT. They're supposed to look and see what is going to be the advantage or disadvantage to the consumer on a market by market basis. And they will get that granular. And like you said, there's often some horse trading. It's like, okay, if you do this, you have to sell your gates at whatever airport to Alaska or something like that. You know, you'll have to do something like that. And I think, you know, the early reads were things were going okay. Yeah, there's some horse trading. But I think it kind of caught a lot of people off guard, myself included, because I have not done a route by route analysis, obviously, of this. I don't know what the government's seeing, but clearly they saw some kind of an anti-consumer issue, at least in some of the markets, and they didn't see a remedy, or JetBlue and Spirit didn't offer enough of a remedy to that in their mind. But I am struck. I mean, JetBlue was... They came into fruition being one of the most politically connected airlines out there. Back in Kennedy, they received slots in the late 90s that hadn't been awarded. No new slots had been awarded in Kennedy in 30 years, and yet they had the political might to kind of pull that through. And of course, they were run by Neilman at the time. And so, I mean, you know, they were able to do it. And I'm just sitting there thinking, wow, they don't have that anymore, it seems like, or they're kind of more like kind of at the will of politics. So. I don't know. I think that if I was guessing, I think that they're probably done. There's going to be some fighting over that $450 million. I think Spirit's going to have to go back to the drawing board. It doesn't make sense to me that they're not profitable. They fly, you know, Airbuses, which are known to be fuel efficient. I mean, this is going to sound really rough, but the only thing I can think of is they must, their competitive variables must not be managed very well or at least from a strategic point of view, they're not doing a good job competing against others. Because really right now, if you can't make money in this environment, especially as a low cost carrier with all the ancillary income available, it's like, dude, you know, what's it going to be like when we hit a tough time, you know?
Well, it's all kind of weird too, right? Because Frontier kind of coming out buying Spirit, which is what started this, kind of shocked everyone. No one ever thought that there was going to be, I mean, maybe there's kind of rumblings that there could be a merger eventually, and there might have been down the road, but I don't think people were really thinking of Frontier and Spirit being the ones that were going to merge. And I remember, if I'm not mistaken, there is some relationship between those two, either CEOs or those two companies, where maybe, I'm not saying they knew some stuff, but it almost kind of seems like Spirit was like, hey, we need someone up. We have set ourselves up for a disaster, and we need someone to come in and buy us out, and let's do this before it kind of gets out. And it almost seemed like it was kind of a, hey, Frontier, let's do this. Like, we can kind of seal the deal. No one's going to block Frontier and Spirit, and we'll make it happen. And Blue just was so persistent and like, well, no, we're going to grow. And eventually the money was too much for the Spirit board, and they thought it could probably pass. And unfortunately got declined. And now the ugly truth, I mean, I hate to say that, cause I don't really know what's going on, but it seems like Spirit was in a much worse position than anyone could ever thought, other than the people that are running Spirit.
That's right. No, I think that is right on point. I do know, you know, when a business is struggling, one of the playbook options, it's an early playbook option, is to be acquired or to sell off some assets or something like that. And, you know, a full acquisition is one thing. You go through the whole merger protocol and whatnot. But then, you know, on top of that, you have some assets that could be, you know, worth a lot of money that you could just sell off parts of that. But what I just don't understand is, you know, I look at their pay scales, I look at their labor force, I look at the equipment, I look at their markets. It's an enigma to me why they don't turn a profit right now in this environment. You know, I do know that some of the low-cost carriers are retooling. You know, Frontier is looking at changing their entire base structure, for instance, to get some efficiencies there, which can be very, very interesting too. So there's definitely some early signs of this, but I just didn't expect there to be an airline that was in that much trouble early on. And then now they're exposed, I suppose to say, for lack of a better word, because apparently the merger is not going to go through.
Yeah. And it makes you think, I mean, let's say they eventually do go through bankruptcy. Does someone try to swoop in again? Is it easier for JetBlue to acquire them? Is it easier for Frontier to acquire them? Or who knows who could acquire them? Is it easier in that situation if there's a true bankruptcy and the government's like, hey, we might lose this airline who employs X amount of people, brings X amount of money into these bases and so forth?
Yeah. Well, and that's what happens during a bankruptcy. The court appoints a trustee. In the case of an airline bankruptcy, it's typically a former CEO or somebody that, you know, has a lot of domain knowledge in the area. And their sole purpose in life is, for this particular purpose, is to, you know, keep the airline in business if possible, if it's got enough liquidity to do so, but also make sure the bills are paid to a certain extent and make sure, you know, people stay employed. And, you know, it could be that if they did go into bankruptcy, you know, if it's a reorganization, which is what it's most likely going to be, you know, that they'll put a plan together and try to emerge from bankruptcy. And I can certainly tell you most of the airlines out there have declared bankruptcy in the past and have reorganized. It used to be a, you know, every 2 to 3 year thing in the 80s, 90s, and, you know, even early 2000s. And so the bankruptcy rules have changed a little bit that make it a little less, you know, they're not, airlines are not incentivized to do that as much anymore, but still it was definitely a part of the reality. And, now if they go through a full liquidation, which I think would be really implausible at this point, but that's where somebody could swoop in, then go to the trustee and say, hey, we'll take the gates and, you know, pick your city. We'll take the gates in Charlotte, or we'll take the gates. And then, you know, there may be a little bidding war for that. And then the trustee will divide that up and, you know, try to pay off everybody as they liquidate everything. But I hate to even say that, because I don't want to increase anyone's blood pressure over this. I think we're a long way from that. But you could see some early signs, like some furloughs, some market contractions and things like that. So those will be things to watch out for.
When you say like furloughs or market issues, would you say furloughs specific to the affected airlines that are in that situation?
Yes. Or yeah. Okay. I don't see
and on the JetBlue side though, right?
Correct. Yeah. I don't see any problems for JetBlue. I don't see any problems for the carriers right now. And I bring up the F word, right? Or the furlough word. And I mean, it's a scary word. I do think it is possible at some point. I mean, the first thing you do when your company is not turning a profit is, you know, you try to shrink your burn, your cash burn. And one of the easiest ways to do that is through, you know, salary, which means in the case of pilots and mechanics and flight attendants, it does mean that you're going to have a reduction, which means a furlough. And the good news is, well, it depends on your perspective, I guess. The good news from a pilot's point of view, furloughs are extremely expensive, and rightly so, right? Because you don't want companies just, you know, from a pilot perspective, just willy-nilly saying, oh, we need to save a little money next month. Let's furlough 300 and then, you know, bring them back in 6 months or whatever. So it's very expensive because it causes all kinds of churn. But on the, and also the other thing is as United found out and others, you have to go back and rehire all these folks when you go back into your growth mode. And if the growth mode happens a lot faster than you anticipated, you know, all of a sudden you're hiring 200 a month, you know, when just a few years ago you let, you know, over 1,000 go, you know. So it's, and United never furloughed, but through like early outs and, you know, early retirements and things like that. So it's kind of a, yeah, it's just kind of a difficult variable to manage. Furlough is usually a last resort, but it's not the last resort before bankruptcy. It's kind of a canary in the coal mine type situation.
Well, what's kind of worrisome about that in my mind is being worried about a furlough and how expensive it's going to be is more of a worry for a company that wants to stick around for a long time rather than a company that wants to get bought out. So if it's truly a survival mode or get bought out, then they're not necessarily looking long-term and how expensive it's going to be to hire everyone back. They're looking short-term. Short-term, how do I save the money? Rehiring people, growth, that's a future problem and probably not my problem. That is JetBlue's problem. That's whoever might end up with this. That's their problem, not our problem.
Right. Well, if you do want to get acquired by like a private equity firm, for instance, or if you want to get, you know, you do want to have some kind of an exit to somebody else, you want to make your balance sheet, you want to make all your financial documents look good. And so you're exactly right. I mean, that is one of the things you can look at. You know, a furlough, I mean, the general rule of thumb, and it varies based on property, but the, you know, if you're going to need those pilots within a 2-year period, that's generally kind of the rule of thumb not to furlough if you're going to need them back. So if you furlough, you want to make sure it's a long-term decision. I mean, obviously it's unbelievable, it affects the lives, you know, of your employees, which is horrible. But on the other side of that, if you know you need to save money for the next 2 years, that's generally the rule of thumb. You know, you can go plus or minus 6 months to a year, depending on the rules in place at a carrier.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's something that you never want to see. It's something that, who knows, maybe they appeal. Like you said, JetBlue doesn't want to pay $450 million. Spirit wants $450 million. I also want to still be an airline or still be in the game. So maybe it's advantageous for both of them to keep trying. Until JetBlue realized that.
Yeah, on that point of keep trying, I mean, they obviously were debriefed on what the exact problems were by the Department of Justice, Department of Transportation. They obviously were told this was our specific concern, right? Because that's what would be litigated in court. Well, we disagree. But so another thing that could happen, but I don't know what's in everyone's mind. Like I said, it costs a lot of money to keep the mergers percolating, you know, but they could go back and say, well, what if we abandon New York, which would, you know, for JetBlue, that'd be unheard of. I'm just talking hypothetically, you know, what if we give that back to the other carrier? So maybe it's something like that, where they go back and see if they can do that. Yeah.
They can have Detroit. Right.
Yeah, right. Poor Detroit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
You think it's something like, all right, election's coming up. We wait 8 months. We see who's elected, and we try again. Or do you think it's a? I guess there's really three options, right? There's give it up, which you said is most likely going to happen. They're both going to go their separate ways. Fire of the $450 million, maybe they pay it, maybe they don't. There's the appeal, or there's the wait and see and appeal later when maybe you get a more favorable, in their eyes, a more favorable judge or court to hear their case,
or a department or a DOJ or a DOT. Yeah, the thing is it's really hard to predict. You know, let me give you, for instance, you know, it used to be the idea was, you know, the Democrats were typically, you know, pro-labor, pro-employee. I mean, I'm obviously painting with a broad brush, and Republicans were typically known more for being aligned with business. But, you know, those lines have really blurred. I mean, you can all go all the way back to Bill Clinton during the American APA strike, you know, what was it, 90 in the 90s. You know, it was like a very short strike in a matter of, a, you know, 20, 30 minute strike, and Bill Clinton ended it. And that was really shocking because that was the first time a Democratic president had kind of flexed and said, no, we're not going to let the workers, you know, strike. because normally a Democrat would have, you know, been more apt to do that. And so, so you just, you can never tell who gets in there and, you know, what their philosophy is going to be. And it could also be a case by case basis. I mean, you know, who knows if next month, I don't know, Allegiant comes and says, we want to merge with Sun Country. You know, I mean, those are much smaller carriers, but the point would be, you know, maybe that would pass without much scrutiny. I'm not saying that's going to happen. It's all hypothetical, but.
Oh, you said it. It's happening. We heard it here first.
Yeah, talk about two completely differently run ops. Yeah. That would be an interesting one.
Well, talking about if you think this was, so say Frontier and Spirit were actually going through with this and they were trying to do this, do you think it would have been an issue? Do you think the fact that maybe JetBlue holds more of a New York esque base and they're a little bit more prominent? I mean, I'm not trying to say one's bigger than the other because everyone views everything differently, but in my mind, maybe JetBlue has a little bit more power to the situation. Maybe they would see as being unfair rather Frontier Spirit team up and they're still same size as JetBlue, maybe a little smaller.
Mm-hmm. So yes, I think the short answer to that is it's possible that Frontier would have fared better for a number of reasons. I mean, the variables that they look at, they really do get into a market by market basis. So if there's two, if the two competitors in a market are JetBlue and Spirit, and then all, so the governments, the investigators are going to say, well, post-merger, there's now going to be one choice in that market, right? And that's going to, in theory, be disadvantageous to the consumer. So that's going to be a strike against them. And if they see too many of those, that's where there's a problem. And then if it's too integrated, like if it's too involved, like you said, with like a New York hub, it could just be to the point where, guys, this just isn't going to work, at least from the government's point of view, because you would have to shut down so many different markets, you know, that you both serve. So if Frontier didn't serve those same markets, which I agree with you, they don't seem to have as much of a concentration in the Northeast as like a JetBlue Spirit would, then maybe things would have gone better. And by the way, that's not off the, you know, that's not off the table. I mean, you know, Frontier could look at this as a big opportunity right now. You got an air carrier that's struggling a little bit, didn't go so well here. We think we're different enough in this merger. Maybe they're a little more politically connected, right? I mean, stranger things have happened in this industry. Yeah.
Maybe they wait to see how Alaska, Hawaii goes and make sure that that goes through. Be like, all right, they're still accepting mergers. They're just not accepting that one. So
we'll
see what happens, you know? Plus, if you're Frontier, you're like, all right, sweet. The company we were going to buy just is $450 million richer. So let's go ahead and swoop in.
Right. And probably a little cheaper now too with all the problems. Yeah.
Obviously we kind of talked about what Spirit is kind of faced with, right? They have the bankruptcy option, which is still very far off, right? If things are truly as bad as it is, bankruptcy, furloughs, that's worst case scenario. Restructuring, maybe figuring it out internally, hiring advisors, obviously they're going to do all that kind of stuff to make it work. But as JetBlue goes, they're going to try to make it work as best as they can, I should say. But as JetBlue goes, they seem very gung-ho on, they want it to be the big five. They don't want it to be the big four. They want it to be the big five. JetBlue wants a seat at the table. They're tired of being told that they don't do international, which now they do, right? They have been rumored to wanting to get wide bodies. They have been rumored to buy almost everyone that's been up for option to be bought. They have tried. So what's next for JetBlue? Are they going to go after someone else? Do you think they sneak into the Alaska Hawaii deal and try to buy one of them? Obviously Hawaii. What do you think would be next for JetBlue?
Yeah, you know, you're absolutely right. They have a duty to grow. They take their duty very seriously. The fastest way to grow is through acquisition, especially, you know, with these kind of carriers out there. So they're always going to do that. They've done a great job of going international. You know, they go over to Europe, as you know, Hawaii. They certainly go a lot of places they certainly go to Europe. I have to double check on the
they go to Amsterdam. So there we go.
Yeah, there you go. And I mean, who would have thought that just even 5 to 7 years ago? I mean, a lot of carriers are using 7.3s for that as well. And I just think to myself, man, this is just me as a consumer. That's a long flight. Some of those flights are long to be on a 7.3 or an Airbus. But that being said, they are finding ways to grow. But JetBlue is cagey. I believe they're well run. They are going to take their shots when there's a shot to be taken. You know, they did lose out on the Virgin deal 4, 5, 6 years ago, whenever that was. Now it seems like a long time ago. They were they were pretty close to, that would have really sealed up the West Coast for them. They would have had a really good West Coast presence. That would have been a nice marriage, you know, then Alaska swooped in. So, I mean, yeah, they're a very active player in the acquisition space, but I still think it has to be right. They're also, because of their DNA, even though they have two fleet types, they still have in their DNA this almost Southwest-like, Needleman-like mentality of less complexity with your fleets. Even though the more flexibility you have, the more markets open up international, they still want to operationally kind of be that same. It's in their DNA. So they're going to have to find the right partner, you know, to really, you know, amalgamate with their current business plan. I don't know that they would ever go after Hawaiian just because of the long haul stuff that some of the, you know, some of the wide bodies they have, but you know, stranger things have happened.
Yeah. I mean, we never thought that JetBlue would be buying Spirit. So, you know, here we are.
Well, that's true. Good point. So,
yeah. Setting this up for future, like we look 10 years down, 5 years down, obviously different political landscape. We can't predict that, but does this ruling pretty much say that they won't let a Delta, United, American, or Southwest ever merge with anyone else? Like they're going to be set in stone?
I mean, no. I think the short answer to that is no. The funny thing is it just, there's times when major mergers go through. I mean, look at the whole American US Air, America West mega merger. Look at the United Continental merger. Look at the Delta Northwest merger. I mean, these are mega mergers. These became large carriers to mega large carriers, you know? And so, and then you look and you see what's going on with JetBlue and Spirit, and you're like, well, that's a little weird that they went through the gauntlet for that, you know? And so I think there's just so many variables that are in play with these things that a lot of things I do think you're still going to see consolidation, you know, somehow, some way.
And, you know, American and JetBlue had that code share. Whether it is some people liked it, some people hated it. It was a very contentious code share. It almost seemed it was kind of forced on everyone, right? Like no one really wanted it except for the two airlines. But do you ever see in a world where maybe American and JetBlue could have kind of a little bit of a marriage there? Because I know when they had that code share, there's a little bit of behind the scenes talk. Like, is this kind of them testing the waters to see how it could work?
Well, a code share, an extensive code share, alliances, things like that, those are all good precepts to the full-on merger, right? I mean, those are predecessors, really. Those are the things you would look for. And it is kind of a way to test the waters, you know? I mean, you can look at it almost like an engagement period before you actually get married to the other carrier. I mean, there's so many different questions you have to ask yourself. Is this going to get approved? You know, or what would we have to give up to get this approved? And then if there's kind of a strategic fit, that might have worked. I'll have to look that up later. But if there's a strategic fit, then you maybe proceed to the next step. Let's try some code shares. Let's see how well our systems talk to each other. You know, our customer reservation system, our ticketing systems, you know, our baggage tracking systems. Let's see how that works. And if you get that down, then it's a pretty logical next step if you think you've got a shot. So certainly code shares. And by the way, code shares, along with code shares comes revenue sharing. So sometimes you can get 75-80% of the benefit of a full-on merger in revenue just by having extensive code sharing agreements.
Wild times. You really can't predict what's going to happen in this industry. Once you think it's just like everyone's happy, they're all set, they're all doing their things, like boom, Frontier's buying Spirit. JK, someone else is buying Spirit. JK, Frontier, you know, it just goes back and forth never ends. You just got to sit back, eat your popcorn, hope you get hired at the right time, at the right carrier, and that's all you can really do, you know, and sit it out and hope for the best because it's most likely going to be a disaster.
Yeah, there's going to be times. Listen, you know, you and I have talked about this before. My kind of philosophy in this industry has always been when times are really good, everyone says this is how it's going to be forever. And then when times are really bad, everyone says this is how it's going to be forever. And even though we've learned to kind of elongate the cycles, and of course we had COVID, and I mean, we've had lots of different things affect the industry. There are going to be natural contractions and expansions, you know, within the industry. And, you know, the advice that we talked about the very first time we ever talked, Justin, was, you know, if you want to get in this industry, I think it's a great industry. It's a rewarding industry for sure. But you should do it not because you're going to make an incredible amount of money, because you might make a lot of money. but you also might end up with a wild ride. The reason you should get in this industry is because you love flying. You're passionate about the job. Those are the people that seem to have long-term endurance in here, you know, and that's the thing. And I'm not saying that people are getting in this for just the pay, but there's a lot of, a lot of press right now about that. And look, we've seen the contracts. My wife works for United. I mean, I've seen those, I've seen what's happened in the last year. I mean, I see it in my bank account and I'm like, holy crap, that's a pretty good, haul. Yeah. And so, that being said, and of course, the regionals, right? I mean, I was reading a thread the other day online where people were talking about their end of year W-2s. And I mean, I don't know if this is true or not. There's no way to verify it, but there was an Endeavor pilot that was an LCA that was making like $450,000 a year. And, I ask around like, oh yeah, that's possible. This is a CRJ pilot that was making that. And I mean, and I just, this is just a little bit of a side. I used to negotiate contracts, right? At American Eagle, I was on the union side. And I, the number one thing that was always shown in her face is the economics don't support this, Jim. Just don't support it. And I always thought to myself, but our economists at ALPA, they're saying they could do it. They just don't want to do it. No, we can't do it. And now here we are, granted it took 20 years, but here we are on the other side of that. And it turns out the economics apparently can support it.
Yeah. You know? Economics can't support it until there's a business reason to do so.
That's the lesson.
There's not a business reason to do it. You're not getting that money. Doesn't matter who's telling you what's going to happen.
There's just got to be a reason. And I get that, but it's just really interesting to me. I was told no so many times on so many different things trying to negotiate contracts that it's just interesting now. I mean, I don't know if any of these are true, but I've heard like the first paycheck at is a PSA, with the whole FedEx, migration. I mean, I heard that first paycheck's is over six figures. Your first paycheck is six figures with the sign-on bonus. I can't imagine a paycheck.
Split up like 250 grand in 2 years, I think it is, something like that.
Yeah. Like, isn't that crazy?
Also, I mean, we could probably spend forever on FedEx. We can touch on them in a little bit because that is also an episode on episode on episode in itself of what's going on over there. All right, let's take a break from today's episode to hear from our sponsor, RAA. As a pilot, you rely on precision planning, trusted resources, and experience each day. And that's just what RAA brings to financial planning. You see, they're uniquely positioned to serve the airline community because RAA was created by pilots to serve pilots, which is why they've earned the trust of and served thousands in aviation industry for more than three decades. But more importantly, RAA's airline specialized advisors understand the unique set of needs, challenges, and goals associated with your career, including those factors that can affect your financial life and security. And that's why it's important to work with the right financial partner. Because whether you're just entering the airline industry or nearing your final flight, the team at RAA is here to support your journey from takeoff to touchdown. Learn more about the benefit of working with an RAA airline specialized advisor today at raa.com/pilot-to-pilot. That's raa.com/pilot-to-pilot.
Now back to today's episode.
Yes. But also, I wanted to touch on this really quick. We won't talk on it too long, but there's also been rumors, maybe not rumors. I saw it one place and I kind of put it off in a distant memory, but it's just been brought back up. American potentially merging in their wholly owned regionals into American. What would that look like? Would that be another A scale, B scale? Well, it just seems like a mess to kind of figure out how to incorporate all that. Now, I don't know the history of regionals and wholly owns and going into a major. There might be a precedent for how you set that up, but it just kind of seems like it's a new thing and people wouldn't really understand how that would
work. Yeah. The concept itself has been around. When I was the MEC chair at American Eagle, which is now, of course, Endeavor, we had a lot of talks with the APA. We were ALPA, of course, they were APA, the Allied Pilots Association at American. We had a lot of talks about seniority list integration. This is, even back in the late 90s, early 2000s. But they were mostly just talks. And the problem is the pay scale differential between the regionals and the mainline was so vast that, this is going to sound really harsh, but I'm just going to tell you what we were told. There's a lot of people, like for instance, at the time, there were a lot of military pilots that were coming into the industry, coming off their military retirement. And, they could go work at United and start on the 7-3 or whatever. Or if there was a seniority list integration, say at American, they would have to come and start on the Saab 340, you know, for substandard. So the idea was they were going to lose a lot of talent in the pool. And this is not to knock my brothers and sisters that flew the Saab. I flew the Saab. And, you know, but my point is that, you know, it would change the entire dynamic of who would come on board and who wouldn't. And who would decide? Could you sit there and say, well, this person's qualified to go fly the 7-3, but this person has to go fly the smaller ERJ? I mean, there's just so many complex issues with that. But now that the pay scales are getting obfuscated and, you know, or you can make pretty good money at one and the other, I mean, there may come a time where this makes sense. I will still say this is still the unions talking, and they have made noise about this in the past. I applaud them to be thinking this way. It's forward thinking. But I haven't heard much on the management side saying, hey, this is a great idea. Let's explore this in greater detail. So that's going to be the next thing to watch for. Because I do think that would solve a lot of the problems these mainlines have with the regional partners recruiting and retaining pilots.
Yeah, absolutely. You would imagine it has to be a recruiting tactic and retaining pilots, because flows are great, but flows still give the pilots the ability to go somewhere else, where if you have the wholly owned is the actual major airline, then you're hired by the airline. You just have to wait for your seniority to go fly 787.
That's just right.
Airline, but you're going to be on the 175 instead of getting hired on at the 737 or 320. And maybe there is, like you said, maybe there's an hour mark. Maybe it goes back to 1500 is to go fly to regional or the wholly owned, whatever they call it, A scale, B scale. I don't know what they'll call it. They'll come up with something crazy to ever happen. But maybe it's just once you reach 3000 hours or whatever, you're allowed to interview for American. I don't know. You've heard about it before, right? But it's just, it's very interesting.
Yeah, there's just going to be a lot of details, and there's going to be groups that become pretty vocal if they feel they're getting disadvantaged, you know, including the company side. But again, I think this is as close as we've ever been to see that. And of course, you know, back in the 80s and 90s, there was even talk, think about this one, Justin, there was talk about a national seniority list. You know, now I've analyzed that in the past, but it would be difficult to make that work, but imagine there being a national seniority list, you know, that, you know, somehow when you enter the industry, you get a seniority number, and that becomes your seniority number for wherever you go. But there's so many complications with that make that tough to work through, but you know, you might start seeing things like that rear their head again.
Yeah, I can't wrap my head around that one. Obviously, I see the benefits of it, but I just don't understand why a company would ever sign off for that. It would truly be whoever pays the most gets the most senior pilots. And that doesn't necessarily mean you get the best pilots, right? It just means you're going to get the most senior pilots.
There's some disadvantages like that. I think that also on top of that, I mean, like if you're at United and then you decide to go fly for American, but you keep that same seniority, I mean, how would that work? You know, so there's a lot of complex issues, you know, with the national. But the point being is you are starting to see some of these issues. I haven't heard that particular one, but that was kind of a hot to trot one in the 90s.
So yeah, we talked a little bit about FedEx. It's crazy what's going on over there. It's truly something I never thought I'd ever see. I haven't been in the industry as long as you, so maybe this isn't as crazy to you, or maybe it's crazier, but for some reason, there is a flow from FedEx to a regional. Not necessarily a flow, right? But there's
definitely a trail of pilots out of Condor, yes.
Signing bonus to leave what has been kind of the top of the top, right? When you think of historically where pilots want to go, some major airline pilots leave to go to FedEx and UPS. That might not be the case anymore, but that historically was kind of one of the best jobs you could have. So talk a little bit about what you've heard going on at old FedEx and what we can expect to hear from them in the next couple of years.
Yeah, absolutely. So you're exactly right. I would consider FedEx near the apex of contracts that are available for pilots. And there's a lot of really hidden positive things in there for pilots. For instance, the majority of their fleet is wide body. So you're probably going to be wide body pay for most of your career, which is not necessarily the case. I mean, I think they have 757s, which are considered narrow body there. But other than that, the 76s on up, everything's a wide body. So you're at wide body pay. You know, you don't really see that so much of the passenger carriers. Those wide bodies are coveted, you know, spots and seniority. So that's point number one. Point number two is we all know during the pandemic that the cargo carriers did quite well. They really bumped up. And in fact, going into the pandemic, there was thought that there was going to be a contraction within the freight market worldwide. And that's one of the early indicators, of course, of a recession. It's, you know, historically been kind of a, you know, when goods are not being shipped as much around the world, that's kind of an indicator that manufacturing is slowing down and all the other economic things that we look at, consumer spending, et cetera. And so that was kind of the thought. Well, then all of a sudden, of course, we know what happened during COVID. Nobody really left their house, but you still needed goods and services. And it became like a boon for both. I mean, look at what Amazon did during that time, but also look at FedEx, UPS, all of them. It was just a boon. It was a great time. Well, of course, now here we are several years later, and they've now kind of rejoined the curve where they were at before. I wouldn't call it a downturn because it's still very good business. But from their point of view, they're thick on pilots. Is that the word? They have a lot of extra pilots. And so the thought process was, if you can encourage them to go work at a regional, the regional is going to get these great experienced pilots. Maybe a pilot's toward the end of their career. Maybe they've got 5-7 years left, you know, and they're at this really high pay at FedEx. But, you know, maybe the schedules have gotten kind of rough. Maybe, you know, they want to do something else. They were able to find a way to get a fair number of these folks to come over. The other thing I would add is FedEx has had some contentious labor negotiations recently. You know, they voted down their contract, which, just, I'm not making an opinion. I'm not telling pilots ever how to vote on a contract. I was surprised that it was voted down, but it was voted down and, you know, voted down quite handedly. And now they've gone through lots of different leadership changes, which is typical after a tentative agreement's voted down, but now they're replacing the people that they replaced. They're kind of in a little bit of a, I don't know what word you'd use for it. A lot of churn within the labor rank and file. By the way, I want to remind every pilot listening, when you're upset with your union, remember you are your union. You literally are your own union. One of the reasons why I took a position in the labor union was because, no offense to my other friends out there, but I saw some of the people that really wanted those labor positions. And quite frankly, Justin, I don't know if they would have been the right people with the right temperament in those positions. You want someone that's strong, someone that advocates, somebody that's not a pushover, but you also can't be a let's burn this place down type person. It just doesn't work. It's not a good long-term philosophy. There is a time to fight, but it's not every single day of, you know, every single flight. And so I think that it's a reminder to everyone to make sure that you get level-headed, strong-willed people into those positions. And if that means it's you yourself, you should go and volunteer for that. Your pilot group needs you. You know, and I'm not saying this happened at FedEx or is happening at FedEx, but it doesn't take much for a group to kind of take over the labor union and cause kind of an upheaval that, you know, kind of spirals for a while. And, you know, again, this is coming from someone that was, you know, heavily involved at ALPA, you know?
Yeah. And do you think there's a part in the back of my brain, I think that we talked about this couple podcasts in the past, that FedEx just really doesn't want to pay them much more money, and they kind of took it personal that last contract didn't go through, and they're like, well, we can pull this out as long as we can. They've been threatening for seems like a year now that they could furlough. It's like, well, you haven't furloughed. So is this just a threaten Are you just threatening? What's the play? Like, it just kind of seems like an empty threat to an extent. I don't know their financial. It just seems like it could be a move on their part. And they're like, we're FedEx. People are always going to want to fly here. No one's going to remember how we're treating you right now. So, and they'll forget. But it just kind of seems like it could be a play.
It absolutely could. And look, no one's in a better position to ascertain, you know, what the working conditions should be, you know, than the company and the union that votes on the contract. I will say, in my opinion, just as a student of labor history and someone that teaches it, and as a former contract negotiator, because the financial situation is shrinking for the company, it is in the company's advantage to delay as long as possible, because the more you get into concessionary times, the better leverage you're going to have in terms of, you know, when you go before the NMB and the mediator, getting released from that to strike is going to be a lot harder if your positions aren't reasonable. And when you're in concessionary times, it really is an advantage company. And so from their point of view, they very well could have said, well, you know what, we tried, we gave them our best offer. You know, this might take a few more years, you know, and let's just do it and roll the dice on it. And that could very well be what's happening.
Yeah, I mean, and to counter my point, Amazon is also in the market now, and they have been doing fairly well from everything that I've seen. Now they're also starting to get into some contract negotiations themselves, but it seems They've taken a huge market share. I don't want to say, I think I'm correct when I say this, but I think I read that they've, no, I don't think that's right, but they are, they're very much into this business, and they are causing kind of a stir between that as well. And I think could be scaring the top echelon and not wanting to throw out a ton of money too.
Yeah. Certainly. And certainly FedEx is very aware of Amazon. This goes back again 6-7 years ago when Amazon pulled the contract. It absolutely affected about, estimates are from 5-10% of FedEx's revenue. And of course, the pandemic came and that kind of cushioned that. But now that we're past that, now you're starting to see kind of that business plan that was pre-pandemic kind of get exposed a little bit. So yeah, FedEx is well aware of the threat of Amazon. There's no doubt. The thing with Amazon right now is theoretically, they're almost like a Part 91 operation because they're just flying their own stuff. They're not, you know, they're not out for hire right now. The question is going to be at some point, will they ever do that? Or are they going to just kind of manage their own stuff? If they ever hold out to the public, you know, I mean, they operate like a 121, and we've talked about this before, but if they ever hold out to the public and all of a sudden you can choose between UPS, FedEx, Amazon, or USPS, you know, now there's a fourth player in there. That'll be really interesting to see what happens, you know, down the road.
Yeah. They don't have a lift for that yet, though. They need
not even close.
Yeah. If they had to buy them, they'd have to buy the amount of airplanes that FedEx or UPS have right now just to make that happen. So,
yes.
That would be,
and UPS still flies a lot of Amazon. Yep.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yep. Yeah. Kind of a interesting. We don't talk about this a lot. I feel like I've said this a lot. We don't talk about this a lot. But when you get to such a point of a contentious headbutt, right? Like there's just a company, there's a union, and you can't get out. Like obviously there's ways to go down. There's mediators, but there's often times where there isn't a mediator. If there's an IBI, interim bargaining agreement, or sometimes when the mediator just doesn't apply, you guys are just at a standstill. The company's like, you used to have this left in your contract. We don't have to be here. This could be a FedEx cases, Southwest in the past, before they signed their contract, they were very heated too. How do you break through as someone that has been in the situation, that's been on the other side, that has seen steam coming out of a CEO of an airline, CEO, how do you keep a level headed? How do you make sure you can break through and still kind of keep the line of communication open and still get your job done?
Yeah, that's a very good introspective question for people that practice in that area. By the way, just as an aside, you know, the NMB does offer mediation services anytime. You can go online if you're an airline or a union, and you literally fill out this postcard size application saying, hey, can you send us a mediator to help us through, you know, on a couple issues? Or you can, you know, the airlines also hire arbitrators to arbitrate their disputes, you know, quite a bit, but you could also bring them in to mediate as well, because there is a difference between mediation and arbitration. Or you can just decide to, no matter what, you're going to go to the system board, which has a neutral arbitrator that's going to kind of decide, and everyone has to live with it. But to your greater point about, you know, we used to call a business relationship, and then there's kind of an adversarial relationship. And there are some companies, unions that manage this a lot better than others. But what I will tell you, the funny thing is once the contract is signed, it's funny how people have pretty short memories, and there's a lot of love now, you know, that kind of let's get back to work. Let's roll up our sleeves. There's a big honeymoon period for quite some time, and people do kind of forget that. But I, you know, there's been times where I've been frustrated, and I'm sure the company is frustrated with me. You know, and I mean, I remember telling one particular individual, you know, I said, the way I practice talking to you is I just go home and I talk to my wall, and that's how I negotiate. That's how I practice with you. And you know, everyone thought that was pretty funny. And, you know, so there are things, and I would like to tell you, and I know I've talked to you about this before, that personalities don't play. It's all business, and people look at the analytics and people look at the data and they make the best decision for that. That's not true. There's still very much a people element. When you get the wrong people in there, it just doesn't take much to throw the whole thing out of kilter. And then, you know, next thing you know, it's, you're 3 years later and there's been no improvements for anybody, company or labor.
Yeah. And it's hard not to take it personal when you're so involved, right? So you this is like, you are the one that is getting, like, directly, you're the one that's affected by this, when really it's 3,000, 5,000 in some airlines, 10,000 pilots that are being affected. So it's really hard to take yourself out of it. I'm sure that's on a company side, and that's also on a union side.
Yeah, absolutely. You do take it personal. You know, it's there's nothing wrong with crying, you know, but I don't cry a whole lot. But the few times I've cried, you know, when my cat died, that was a really sad moment. My grandmother died. And when we lost our scope arbitration at Eagle, those were the times that I really shed a tear, because your heart and soul is into this. You think you got a great case, you think you've got it won, and then boom, you know, something just completely unexpected happens and you're completely personally invested in it. And yeah, absolutely. And there's also a reason why pilots, flight attendants, dispatchers, also a reason why they're elected people. They're from the rank and file, so that they have to feel what they negotiate. It's, you don't hire professional negotiators that come in because they don't have to walk into the crew room and feel the ire of, you know, why did you negotiate this? So there's a reason why we do that.
Right. Good luck with that contract.
Thanks for the paycheck.
We did a way better job at blah, 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 you know?
Like, right. Well, I do hear that from pilots every now and then, like, why don't we hire professional negotiators? Fair point. And, you know, like ALPA, APA, they do have professional negotiators, but the people that are actually at the table, they're advising the people that are at the table. They are pilots that are trained, and they are highly trained. We go through a lot of training to become a negotiator, and it's, you know, not for everybody.
Well, you also got to understand what you're giving up too. It's like a company can be very smart and be like, hey, we just want this one thing. It's like, well, that one thing is going to not let us give the money that you're promising over here if we do this. They have to know the ins and outs of everything. And a professional negotiator, obviously they're professionals, but if you haven't been in the industry for a long time, you could very easily overlook something in what you think is a slam dunk, but really it's not a slam dunk.
Very easily. It's called lying in the weeds. When the other side's lying in the weeds, they're setting something that, you know, if they need it, that they'll you know, they've got it ready that they can pounce on. And it's your worst fear as a negotiator, that you sign off on something, you recommend something, and, you know, the pilots vote for it, and then 3 years later you find out that it was kind of a trap, or there was a trap set in there. Sometimes it's unintentional trap. Sometimes it's, you know, the company was innocent in it, or the union was innocent in it, and you find out, wow, this thing really has some teeth, and, you know, really affects a lot of people. That's your worst fear.
Yeah. Moving on a little bit, let's talk. We have to talk a little about it, but what's going on at Boeing, man? What are we going to do? I mean, obviously, more people are getting involved. It seems like Boeing is being a little bit open about it, right? Like, hey, this is not okay. You know, the CEO came out and had that kind of drastic statement and said they're going to kind of look at everything. But it just seems like the MAX has just been beat up and just has had some issue after issue after issue. What's the next play there?
Yeah, the MAX has been beat up. And, you have to look at Boeing. I mean, just in full disclosure, I have good friends that work in the safety department over at Boeing. And so, you know, I'm sure they might be listening, or this might find their way to them. So this is, there's really good people at work at Boeing. I know them. I can tell you that flat out. And I'm sure everyone knows that. That being said, something happened at Boeing. A lot of people think it was the McDonnell Douglas merger. There was a big culture change. Of course, we've seen the Netflix documentary on that. I mean, I don't know, but if I hear the word quality leak another time from either the CEO or something like that, I can't take that anymore. When bolts are, you know, on the ground after an aircraft's been in service for 3 weeks, 4 weeks, that's not cool, man. I mean, there's, you know, you can't do your job that way. And I don't know, this is not the Boeing that I grew up with. You know, this goes all the way back to was the MCAS system, you know, with the, you know, not telling the pilots about it, you know, automating things away. And it's like, you know, that is not in Boeing's DNA. I mean, that's, you know, no, Airbus has a much different philosophy. That's an Airbus thing. And so sometimes I tell people, this is what happens when a company tries to be another company. When Boeing tried to be Airbus for a few days, they started automating a few things, not telling the pilots about it. It's worked for Airbus, but it doesn't work for Boeing because no one's ready for that. And I don't know. I don't know what it's going to take. I mean, I'm thankful that the Southwest crew was obviously skilled, handled that, got the plane down. And selfishly, my wife's affected by this because she flies the MAX at United. And so it's really changed. It's really changed a lot of things there. They're both carriers are trying to manage it, Alaska and there's other carriers worldwide, and United are the two biggest ones affected. But I don't know. At first you're thinking, well, this is just going to be a few days. They're going to get everything inspected, you know, and signed off. And now the FAA has come out and said they're in no hurry. This might be, and I want to prepare everyone for this, might be another one of those, you know, maxisms where we're talking months before the FAA is convinced. They're already talking about removing DER approval, which is kind of what pilots know as DEs. Well, they have the same thing in aircraft manufacturing. They're company employees that kind of come in and sign off for certification, but they're employed by Boeing in this case. The FAA is already saying, you know what? Nah, I think we're going to pull some of that authority and bring it back to the FAA because of some of these issues. And the thing about that is that's going to greatly delay things. I mean, not just because the government's slow and burdensome, but the truth is the kind of people that you need to make those decisions are the kind of people that make big salaries that you don't find in the FAA. And I have a lot of friends in the FAA too, that work in certification. They're brilliant people, but you know, that's the life they chose was to, you know, help out there. But the kind of people these DERs are, you know, they're probably $500,000 employees that, you know, you can't afford in the FAA. So I don't know what's going to happen. And I mean, someone's going to have to convince the FAA examiners, the manufacturing examiners, that things are good and that they've fixed it out, and hopefully it resolves, but it could be a while.
What do you think will come of the MAX? Like, obviously, you know, we know where it is right now, but is there a world where the MAX itself is kind of forced out? I would say maybe not necessarily, like, you can't stop selling what you already made, right? Like, you can't, I mean, maybe you can do that, but I'd imagine more people are going to be a little bit more worrisome for that airplane, or Boeing in general. But what do you think they do next? Obviously, everyone's talked about the 797. Are they even working on the 797? You feel like you don't hear any rumors about anything anymore. Is it currently something being built? Like, I don't know if you know. I'm kind of just like thinking out of my head. Right?
Last I heard about the 797 was a 2028. You know, I think they announced at the Paris Air Show a year ago or something. So who knows there? That'll be an interesting one to watch. In the case of the MAX, I think we're already seeing this with the MAX 10. MAX 10 was supposed to be in service last year, and of course, that all got delayed. And so what you're seeing now is some of the carriers that had MAX 10 deliveries, they're able to defer those to like 900 ERs, you know, and other types of airframes. And so you might see this naturally kind of take care of itself. I'm sure you get them. I get texts every now and then from family and friends saying, hey, I'm on a MAX. Is this going to be okay? Can I fly on this today? I do get those. And, you know, my answer is, of course, you can fly on those. But you're right. There's a perception variable out there with the public. And when they hear MAX, I don't know if you remember the DC-9, I'm sorry, the DC-10, you know, that's why that became the MD-11, was because, you know, the marketing folks made a calculation there saying, hey, let's put winglets on it, upgrade the engines a little bit, put some avionics in there, and voila, it's no longer the DC-10, it's the MD-11, and it seemed to work. Or, and again, this is many, many years ago, and I don't want to bring up bad memories, but, you know, ValueJet had a really bad reputation, and so then they became AirTran overnight. AirTran, they merged with AirTran. AirTran had like two or three aircraft. ValueJet had, you know, 60, 70. The surviving carrier was AirTran because of marketing said that's a better name than ValueJet after those accidents. And of course, AirTran then eventually, many, many years later, were acquired by Southwest. But my point is, the public is fickle. They will fall for that. If I was a marketing person at Boeing, I would, one, I'd tell the engineers to fix the problems. Don't put out these products anymore that where bolts are falling off. But then two, we got to get rid of the word MAX. You know, I mean, I'm sure you've seen the memes online, the duct tape and the different things, you know, boring, and, you know, like you're boring a hole. I mean, there's so many bad memes out there right now that eventually it's going to catch on. So I think they need a marketing redo. And I've said this for a while. I wouldn't call the next model a MAX anything.
Yeah. No, MAX needs to be gone.
I would get rid of it. It's already got a stigma.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd agree. Even my iPhone 15 Max, you know, now that's got a stigma too. What's going to happen there?
Yeah, right.
Moving on from that a little bit, talk a little bit about pilot hiring. What's the word on the street for you? Because I feel like there's a sense of a little bit of, I don't want to say people are freaking out, but, you know, they're not as like, I don't want to say excited, but there's this little bit of worry out there right now. It seems like some things are up in the air. Now, it's easy to say that training is backed up. I feel like that's kind of been an excuse for maybe the last 6 months or so, especially at the regionals. I think they said that they had a lot of first officer training back up. So, you know, class dates are getting pushed out. Southwest just recently said that they're going to be not necessarily stopping hiring, but suspending hiring for right now. They canceled anyone that had an interview coming up and they had to reapply. What do you see? What have you heard? what's kind of your prediction as well of what's going to happen in the next couple of years? Is the pilot shortage not as bad as what we thought? Kind of take all those questions and answer them as you want to.
Sure. Well, of course, the airlines have hired tens of thousands of pilots, at the major ranks, the legacy ranks, over the last couple of years, unlike anything we've ever seen in the history of hiring. Okay. So there clearly was a shortage there. There's no doubt to keep up with both the attrition. Some of the attrition was artificial because of the early retirements and, the furloughs and layoffs and whatnot. But much of it now is to cover growth, So if the airlines want to keep growing, they're going to have to keep hiring. There certainly had, when we were at full afterburner, at the apex of this, Delta and American and United were hiring 2,000 pilots a year, which is just crazy if you think about that. That's absolutely phenomenal hiring rate. Remember what I said earlier, everyone said this is how it's going to be forever. Well, Delta, of course, recently came out and said they're going to cut it back a little bit down to 1,000 a year. But I got to tell you, historically, even 1,000 pilots a year hired at Delta, it's a lot, man. It is a lot of pilots being hired. And then if you also look at the retirements that are on the horizon, we still have not hit the teeth of the forced retirements. Now, of course, there's this age 67 thing that's sticking out there. And certainly there could be a little bit of a gap or a little bit of a delay like we saw before. No doubt about that. But just assume everything stays the way it is right now. The fundamentals have not changed. There's still going to be very, very healthy hiring. Is it going to be full throttle? Everyone's taking anyone they can? No. And you're already starting to see that. You're starting to see some applicants that are being, try again, maybe next time type stuff. You are starting to see that a little bit, some of these carriers, but it's still a very, very good time. And I think, if you're making a long play in this industry, again, don't come in it because you want to make a lot of money and you want to make a killing. That very well may happen, but come in it because you're passionate about it. You're willing to kind of take the trials and tribulations. There could be some turbulence along the way, but long term, it's looking really good.
No, I totally agree. Let's see what else we got going on right now. What's the word with, I can't remember the airline that's doing it. Who is hiring Australian pilots?
Yeah. Is that SkyWest?
We have to come up. We got to figure out who it was, but I know Breeze tried to, but I don't know if they actually were able to.
Well, Breeze definitely has been, you're right. Maybe it was Breeze. What was SkyWest doing though? Were they hiring? Maybe that was more of a visa sponsorship program. So I apologize if I offended any SkyWest folks. I could have my facts wrong on that, but, you are seeing some very interesting ideas being tried, right? Obviously pay isn't solving all of the issues at the regional. So now they're looking at other things as well. There has been talk for a long time about bringing foreign pilots, but the truth is there's shortages everywhere. There's not this big excess of pilots waiting somewhere in the world, or mechanics for that matter, that are just waiting to be sponsored for a visa ship over here in the United States. So can that stopgap a few things here and there? Maybe, but I don't see that as a long-term strategy unless the airline's willing to open up a flight academy and participate in ab initio like training for those folks.
Yeah. No, I was trying to look through all the questions that I had, but someone asked me about Australian pilots. Like, I've heard that more than once. Oh, it just says Australian.
Something about Breeze. There was something about Breeze hiring international pilots. I don't remember all the details, but yes, I do recall that.
All right, here's a good question. I could probably leave with some more questions, so we'll kind of end on it with this. But what's the job market right now for low-time pilots, especially ones that are trying to avoid the CFI route? And more particularly, we can kind of get into people being in a weird situation where they're signing training contracts in a time where probably training contracts don't make the most sense in the world. But we'll talk about what it looks like to be a low time pilot right now. We can also compare it to what it was like to be a low time pilot 10 years ago and how it's still a great time. And you have so many opportunities right now, even though it might seem like you don't, but let's talk about being a low time pilot right now and just the multitude of opportunities that you have at your fingertips.
Yeah. And, let's talk about the CFI thing first, because I do hear that a lot from students. I don't really want to be a CFI. I get it. It's not for everybody. Not everyone likes to teach. You know, it can be, it's nice if you have passion for it, but completely understandable if it's not someone's cup of tea. That being said, for civilian 121 airline pilots, 85% of them have at least 1 hour of dual given in their logbook. So it is absolutely the tried and true approach. I've mentioned this before. I personally believe that being a CFI really helps you. There's something about strapping yourself next to somebody that's trying to kill you day in and day out that really makes a pilot out of you. It makes you a better communicator. It makes you a better decision maker. I mean, I think it's our tried and true way. But all of that being said, there certainly are a fair number of pilots who are like, you know what? I hear you, Jim. I get it. I just can't do it. I can't be the flight instructor thing. Well, you know, there are opportunities. There are going to be in the 91 world. You know, I mean, I look back at my wife before she was building time. You know, she flew tours out in Maine, you know, lighthouse tours and stuff like that. She literally was at the side of a road in Bar Harbor, which is Acadia National Park, a beautiful part of the United States. She had a drive-up booth. You'd drive up, the Cessna was right there. You'd go take a tour and she'd fly you around, show you all the lighthouses or show you all the celebrities that live in the area or whatever and land. And you know, that's how she built a lot of her time. There's fire patrol. There's obviously banner towing, the parachute stuff and the skydiving and the banner towing, I would just be really careful of. I have friends. I know of people that have been hurt and killed in those industries. I'm not knocking those industries, but you know, just be really careful who you fly with that. You know, I mean, sometimes it's like, hey, there's room in the airplane. We can put the 18th skydiver in my Cessna 206. No, you can't. Right. So there's things like that you have to watch out for. But there are ways to do it. The one thing I would caution everyone against is what we talked about, the training contracts there. There are carriers out there. Like usually they're like 135 freight. There might be some 135 passenger that what they'll do is they'll say, hey, you can come work for us. You can sit in the right seat. And you know, for you could do that at whatever 250 hours, or maybe it's 500 hours for the 135 men's. And then at some point you'll upgrade to captain. But all you have to do is you have to sign this training contract. And this training contract says that if you leave, you know, we'll prorate it. But if you leave, you know, you have to fly so many months as captain or whatever. And if you leave, then you owe us whatever, $20,000, $30,000. And I have had people call me and say, hey, is that legal? Well, one, I'm not an attorney. But what I have learned talking with attorneys is it really depends. I mean, it depends on state law. It depends on how aggressive the airline wants to be. It depends on, and they have more than one thing. It's not just about them suing you, although that does happen. There's a famous case of a carrier right now that's got, I don't know, north of 20, 25 cases in a small claims court in Florida against pilots trying to enforce the training contract, but they can go after credit ratings and stuff like that. And the other thing I want everyone to pay attention to is let's say you're biding your time at one of these carriers. You're like, okay, I don't have $20,000 to pay, so I have to stay here. And I'm not alleging this happens on any one carrier, but I have had pilots call me with these situations and all of a sudden they're like, hey, you need to go take this route. I know the weather's bad. I know the icing equipment's not working. And you're like, well, I don't want to take the route. They're like, well, if you don't take the route, you're fired. And by the way, it said in your contract, you owe us $20,000. I can tell you there are pilots that feel that has happened to them. Full disclosure, I'm working with a law firm as an expert witness trying to help these pilots. Because I feel horrible for them. And I just wish I would have gotten to them at the beginning of this saying, hey, I know it looks like a shortcut. And by the way, for some people, it may make perfect sense. But everyone has to look at it from their perspective and keep a critical eye on it. I personally would never sign a training contract. I think that an operator that makes their people do that, they should look at better ways to incentivize and retain and recruit. But that being said, I would just be really careful and I'd avoid that. There's not too many, at least every few months, I get a call from a pilot in a situation like this where they just feel the weight of the world on their shoulders. They don't know how they're going to repay this stuff, you know, and they sometimes have to go get an attorney. Sometimes they have to settle with the company, but it's seldom a very good outcome.
Yeah. And it's a headache too, right? And it just makes you really kind of kick yourself in the butt and doesn't make you excited about aviation and can really kind of hurt your future. Not necessarily from reputation today, but it can just kind of ruin the way you look at the career and make you want to get out. But I'd also say that I did not go the CFI route. So I was, And I partly blame myself for kind of putting this out there, which I'm guessing people did as well. But I was very adamant that I didn't want to be a CFI. I just didn't think I was going to be a good CFI. So
sure, yeah,
I went to go get my CFI. Like, I was training to be a CFI, but I was actively searching for jobs. I was able to find a job, aerial survey. And I was like, all right, peace. I'm done with my, I don't need my CFI anymore. So I'm just going to go do this. I worked for, I mean, it's pretty well known, especially in the area, but it's got a reputation. It's, sure. I mean, I lost an engine in a 206 and I landed on the side of a mountain in West Virginia. So, I mean, like, that's kind of the reputation I'm talking about. That's right. The risk that you're going to take when you do go the other way. Now, that's not to say that can't happen as being a CFI, because there's some shady operations out there on the CFI side as well. But you have to understand that when you make that choice to go away from the tried and true CFI route, you're really opening yourself up to way more things, like training contracts, like understanding maintenance, understanding when and how to say no, understanding just the whole viewpoint that you need to have as a general aviation pilot in the real world. You don't know that at 250 hours, at 300 hours. That's something that you learn as time goes on. Now, do you know that at 1,000 or 1,500 hours? I don't know. But
Right.
Feel more comfortable making those decisions with 1,000 or 1,500 hours rather than the 300 hours I have, you know? So,
Justin, I'm going to make you feel better. No, yeah. That's a good, I'm going to make you feel better, because guess who else doesn't have their CFI?
This guy.
Me. this guy. So it's one of my biggest regrets. I wish I would have, you know, and when I went into the airlines, I became a line check airman and had to go through all the fundamentals of instructing and all that stuff. And for me, it was fascinating. Everyone else had their CFI and it was boring for them. But I couldn't afford it at the time. I could not afford to get my CFI. I had nothing. I mean, I had all these student loans and everything like that. And so I was fortunate enough to get a job at a 135 carrier. This is pre, you know, restricted ATP, pre-ATP days anyway. So I was able to kind of work my way up that way. But yeah, I also, so even though I may sound hypocritical saying go get your CFI, I still, like you, I think that that's the primary route. But it's not for everybody. And I'm not going to sit here. I mean, I do have students come and tell me things where I'm like, yeah, it sounds like this probably wouldn't be a good one for you, you know, and you know, everyone has to work their own way out. But your advice was spot on. Just be prepared. Be prepared for a slightly different experience that's not as well tested as, you know, the cookie cutter, for lack of a better word, you know, CFI to regional to major airline, because it could be a lot more rocky. The road could be a lot more rocky.
You're going to be faced with those real world scenarios that people, life or death, you know, and making these decisions, and you have low time. It's definitely interesting. And they know that, and they kind of pry off that a little bit too. It's
for sure.
Up done. If you're not going to do it, we'll get someone else. That might not be as much of an issue now because they need pilots, but mentality is still out there, those operators. I had a thought that I was going to say, but I can't remember. Oh, I was going to say, one of my good friends, he's currently at Delta right now. I kind of tracked our careers together. We both went to Ohio State. We both were kind of training similar times. We both got hired at our first jobs. He was CFI. I did aero survey. There was no difference in how many hours that we had. I feel like we were at the same level, progressing the same way. Now, I chose a different route than he did, but hour-wise, I feel like we were right there the whole time. So you're not going to get one. I mean, maybe some scenarios you will. Like, if you're a flight instructor in Florida, you probably do better than a flight instructor in Columbus, Ohio. But being a flight instructor itself, it's not going to take you more time or less time than going out and flying aerial survey, freight, whatever it is.
Yep. Well, when my wife was a flight instructor, part 61, the biggest part of her job was going out trying to find students. Right. So, you know, that she spent probably half her time trying to find students, you know? And so yes, absolutely. And same for me, you know, I track mine to all my friends. I left University of North Dakota from, and, you know, we've all ended up at various places, you know, at about the same time, you know, give or take a year or 6 months or whatever. But yeah, you know, your point's well taken. There are multiple paths that people can take to get to their goal. My whole point was on the CFI thing, and it might come across as hypocritical, but, you know, sometimes people just don't want to do it, you know, and I'm like, you know, it is the proven path. It'll be the one that has, I shouldn't say the least aggravation, but it has the most known variables for you. Many people have gone down that path, you know, and when you get your interview for your job, you know, it'll be interesting because, you know, the person interviewing you probably went through the same path you went through. So it'll be, you know, there'll be a lot of similarity there. But by the same token, you might not have quite as cool a story as if you went out and flew, right? So, I mean, I remember I had several emergencies at my first job that my friends that went through the CFI rank, they didn't have that, you know, like you landed on the side of a mountain in West Virginia. And by the way, I soloed in West Virginia. So I know what that terrain looks like. So absolutely.
We flew over Morgantown, West Virginia, and we were like, this would be a really bad place to lose an engine just as we flew by. And then about like 10 minutes later, boom, it was done.
The entire state. West Virginia is one of the most beautiful states I've ever seen in my life. But from a landing point of view, there's just not a lot of places to put a plane down.
Not ideal, that is for sure. And I wanted to touch right now about the mentality of, say, a younger pilot. You might think that you have it bad, but you do not understand what people had to go through the 90s, early 2000s. You know, I mean, I personally had a pretty easy path, but 3-4 years before me, 2008 through 2002 through 2010, to be a flight instructor, you had to have thousands of hours. To get hired at AeroSuper, you would have thousands of hours. And you weren't making livable wages at all. You were getting paid. You were not making any money at all. It's the fact that you need to make 50 grand as a flight instructor. When I started training, that blows my mind. I never thought that would ever happen, which is just crazy.
No, your point's well taken. I remember in, was it 2008, maybe it was 2007 at UND, there was 180 people that applied to be a flight instructor. And I think they took like 6 or 7. And, you know, these are people that had, you know, all kinds of experience before. I mean, they were the cream of the crop, so to speak. And it was deflating for people at the time. And, you know, what do you do with that? You know, right after college, I had to go sell suits for a while. You know, that's what I did. I sold suits at the local JCPenney's. And people do forget that. I do feel, though, Justin, like whenever I mention this to people, it sounds like, what do the kids say nowadays? Boomer, you know, I sound like this old guy saying, you know, how tough I had it. But it is true. It's just a much different experience. You know, jobs are much, I mean, just to get hired at a regional, you had to have your ATP, which you went out and self-funded. You had to have probably at least 2,500 hours with 500 hours of multi. I mean, those were the things you had to have just to get someone to read your resume and interview for the few slots they have. So it was definitely a different time. People don't have an appreciation of that. I doubt we have to go back to times like that, but you never know. I mean, people need to still stay competitive.
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of why I bring it up is you never know what the future is going to hold, and what you thought was a bad time really was a great time. But you have a lot of opportunities. Don't sign a training contract if you can avoid it. Obviously, there's certain situations where maybe you have to. And if that's the case, get a lawyer to read it through and understand what you're yourself into, what your legal rights are. Because if you just sign that thing fat, dumb, and happy, it's going to burn you eventually. And it could be as simple as a situation where you want to say no to a trip, and they say, we're going to fire you. And you're like, all right, we'll fire him. You're like, hey, by the way, you're going to owe us 20 grand. You'd be like, all right, well, I'm going to go start the plane up.
You know? Right. It's like, no, and I'd like to tell you that I wouldn't start the plane up, Justin. Oh, sorry, I interrupted you. Sorry about that. I'd like to tell you I'm that person that would put my foot down and stand and say, oh, I'm not going to go. But I wouldn't. I guarantee you if I was facing with $20,000, it'd be really hard for me to not go start that plane up, you know? And so I, you're absolutely right. I mean, no doubt about it.
All right, Jim, I have enough of your time. It is late. Let's get back to it. Well, last thing I asked you is, how cold is it in North Dakota right now?
God, right now it was only 1 degree today, so we were good. But previous weeks, it was, I think the wind chill tickled minus 50, which I got to tell you, that is just unbearable. I call my friends down at Embry-Riddle. Just, I have really good friends down there. I'm like, hey, you guys hiring? No, I'm just kidding to my friends in North Dakota. But I'll tell you, when it's that cold, man, it just takes the breath out of you, you know?
Well, tomorrow, where I live in North Carolina, it is, there's a huge warning right now because it's going to be a low of 19.
19. Low of
19. Yep. I remember when I lived in Chicago, I think it was my second winter there. It was negative 53. And now I'm worried about your pipes freezing and just another day in Chicago. No, they don't cancel much. Light the train tracks on fire, get people going.
That's right. Absolutely.
North Carolina, man. I love it. I'm glad to be back home. Great. But
that's right.
It's not that cool.
Well, stay warm, man.
Jim, thanks for coming on, man. I appreciate it. We'll have to do this again soon, all right?
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, Justin.
Thank you. Aviation, thank you so much for listening to today's episode. I hope you enjoyed it. Like I said earlier, if you like the podcast, make sure you follow Pilot the Pilot. This way you have the opportunity to, one, see more podcasts, and also you can ask questions when I offer the opportunity for questions for these kind of podcasts. Check out the hats, like I said earlier, on boldaviator.com. Go to the collaborator section, and you can get yourself a sweet Pilot the Pilot hat. That's all I have for you today. Hope you enjoy the podcast, and have a great day. And as always, happy flying. Pilot the Pilot LLC is compensated to make recommendations to his or her followers regarding the services of RAA or Allworth Airline Advisors, companies of Allworth Financial, LP, or Allworth. Promoter is not an employee or investment advisor representative of Allworth. Promoter is a current client of Allworth. Allworth-based promoter fee of $4,000 a month for sponsorship of the Pilot podcast. Due to the compensation arrangement between Allworth and promoter, promoter has an incentive to recommend Allworth, resulting in material conflict of interest. Promoter's role on behalf of Allworth is limited strictly to making recommendations regarding the services of Allworth, introducing or referring prospective clients to Allworth. Promoter has no responsibility with respect to Allworth's investment advisor or other advisory services.